Hello, everybody. It's Mr. Tall 23 back in their video. Want to do a quick sound check first to make sure that the sound is working? Should be. All right. Okay, so the sound is working. So I'm going to continue the video which I started yesterday, refuting the supposed Bible contradictions that skeptics of the Bible will bring up. Now, if you haven't watched the first part of the video, I recommend going and watching that first before watching this part. This is part two. So if you don't remember, or if you're just going to watch this video without watching the first part, I'm addressing a video which is very popular on YouTube. It has about 3 million views. I just looked it up. It's called Bible Quiz Show Contradictions or something like that. It's made by some atheist guy who makes anti-Christian cartoons. The channel name is Non-Stamp Collector. And the video is very popular. If you read the comments, it's all a bunch of unbelievers who are like, oh, the Bible's so dumb or whatever. But when you actually look at the contradictions which he brings up, they're not contradictions if you actually study the Bible. And I explained that at the beginning of my video yesterday about how to rightly divide the word of truth. And as you, if you watched the video from yesterday, you'll know that every single one of them, which he brought up so far, is not a contradiction if you actually study it. So this next section of his video are numeric contradictions. So in parallel passages, such as Samuel and Kings with Chronicles, because they tell the same story, or the four Gospels, he says that there's numbers given in different accounts which differ from each other, and that's a contradiction. So you'll see what I mean as I go through these examples, but as before, every single one of these can be answered and refuted that they're not contradictions. So the first one is the supposed contradiction that one verse says 800,000, another verse says 1.1 million. So in 2 Samuel 24:9, it says, "And Joab gave up the sum of the number of the people unto the king. And there were in Israel 800,000 valiant men that drew the sword, and the men of Judah were 500,000 men." 1 Chronicles 21, verse 5 says, "And Joab gave the sum of the number of the people unto David, and all they of Israel were 1,000,000, and 100,000 men that drew sword. And Judah was 400 threescore, and 10,000 men that drew sword." Well, the answer to this supposed contradiction lies in a careful look at the words in these verses and a comparison to other scriptures. Firstly, notice that in 2 Samuel, it's written that there are in Israel 800,000 valiant men. On 1 Chronicles, it says, "All they of Israel were 1,000,000 and 100,000 men," which is 1.1 million or 1,100,000. Now consider the following verse. 1 Chronicles 27, verse 1 says, "Now the children of Israel, after their number, to wit, the chief fathers and captains of thousands and hundreds, and their officers that served the king in any matter of the courses, which came in and went out month by month throughout all the months of the year, of every course were 24,000. So there were different courses of officers who came in and went out month by month throughout all months of the year, according to this verse. So there's 12 months in a year. And according to this verse, there's 24,000 in each course. So if you multiply 12 by 24,000, you get 288,000 of these additional soldiers, which are not part of a standing year-round army. In 2 Samuel, the number of 800,000 is referring to the standing army within Israel, while in 1 Chronicles, the number is given of all they in Israel which drew the sword. So if you add 288,000 to the 800,000 number, you get 1,088,000, so 1,088,000 or 1.088 million, which can be rounded up to 1.1 million in 2 Chronicles 21:5. Now, the same thing occurs with the number of Judahites. In 1 Chronicles, it says that there's 470,000, and it's just rounded up to 500,000 in 2 Samuel. So they're roundings, not exact numbers. I don't know where people get this idea that the Bible doesn't round numbers at all. I mean, a lot of these contradictions have to do with, and other contradictions I've heard, which are not addressed in this video, I've heard are based on the assumption that for some reason the Bible never rounds numbers up or down, which is just stupid. People round numbers all the time. So that's exactly what's going on here. It's the 800,000 standing army plus the 288,000 who go in every month, 24,000 of each month, which is then rounded up to 1.1 million. So again, it's not a contradiction if you're actually willing to do the biblical research. And the next supposed contradiction are the numbers 700 or 7,000. In 2 Samuel 8, 4, it says, "And David took from him 1,000 chariots and 700 horsemen and 20,000 footmen. And David halved all the chariot horses, but reserved of them 400 chariots. 1 Chronicles 18, 4 says, "And David took from him 1,000 chariots and 7,000 horsemen and 20,000 footmen. David also halved all the chariot horses, but reserved of them 100 chariots." So in this context, David is going to battle against Hadadrezer. One of the accounts says that David had 700 horsemen, while the other says that he has 7,000 horsemen. Now, the answer to this is that horsemen does not necessarily denote a single role. No horseman is simply trained as a horseman only. They fight on foot as well. I don't know if people understand this, that people can get off horses. I don't think these skeptics are that dumb that they can't figure out that people which are on horses can get off the horses, that cavalry doesn't necessarily have to always be mounted on a horse. But anyway, a horseman can also be a footman. In 1 Chronicles 19, 18, it says 40,000 footmen, for example. But in 2 Samuel 10, 18, it says 40,000 horsemen. The words are used interchangeably because horsemen are also footmen. It's not a contradiction in these two verses, in 2 Samuel 10, 18 and 1 Chronicles 19, 18, either, because of the fact that they're the same thing, in the sense that every horseman is also a footman. So it's absurd to say that somebody who is trained to ride a horse can never get off their horse and fight on foot. How they fight, how the battle ends up, depends on the geography of the battle and other conditions. Now, if you look at 2 Samuel 8, 4 and 1 Chronicles 18, 4, the total number of footmen given is 20,000 in both passages. The 700 and 7,000 number are both included in that 20,000, because every horseman is also a footman. It's just told from two different perspectives. It's entirely possible that 7,000 were deployed on horseback, but later in the battle, only 700 actually fought on horseback because of the location of the battle and because David decided that 6,300 of them would have been better fighting on foot. So it's not a condition or contradiction when you consider that simple fact. Now, the next supposed contradiction is also numerical. It's the number 600 or the number 50. In 1 Chronicles 21, 25, it says, "So David gave to Ornan for the place 600 shekels of gold by weight." And 2 Samuel 24, verse 24, it says, "And the king said to Arunah, 'Nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price, neither will I offer burnt offerings unto the Lord my God of that which doth cost me nothing.' So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver." So the question is, did David pay 600 shekels of gold or 50 shekels of silver for the threshing floor? The answer is 50 shekels of silver, as recorded in 2 Samuel 24:1, or not 24:1, 24:24. 1 Chronicles 21, verse 25 does not even concern the price of the threshing floor specifically, but the whole place, as it's written. David bought the property, the whole area where the threshing floor was, the land upon which it was, for 600 shekels, while the threshing floor itself with the oxen was 50 shekels. So it's not a contradiction either. Now, the number 800 or 300. Now, this one's kind of silly. How many were slain by the mighty men of David according to the Bible? In 2 Samuel 23:8, it says, "These be the names of the mighty men whom David had. The Tachmonite that sat in the seat, chief among the captains, the same was Adino the Esnite. He lift up his spear against 800, whom he slew at one time." You got that? It says in 1 Chronicles 11:11, "And this is the number of the mighty men whom David had. Jashobeam and Hachmonite, the chief of the captains, he lifted up his spear against 300 slain by him at one time." Now, these verses are talking about two entirely different people. One is talking about Adino the Esnite, who slew 800, and the other is Jashobeam the Hachmonite, who slew 300. The Bible records that there were 30 chiefs, and three of them were considered the three mighties. In 2 Samuel 23, it names the three mighties as Adino the Esnite, Dodo the Ahoite, and Shammah the son of Agi the Ararite. These are the three who went down with David to the cave of Adullam, according to 2 Samuel 23:13 and 1 Chronicles 11:15. But 1 Chronicles does not name the three men, but only names Dodo the Ahoite. Now, Dishobium was one of the 30 chiefs, but he was not the same person. He was not of the Three Mighties. He was not the same person as Adino the Esnite. These aren't contradictions, because if you actually just read the verse and see that they're not talking about the same people, you know that there's two different people who slew a different number of people. So it's not a contradiction again. Now this one, the next few actually concern the Gospels, so we're past Chronicles and Kings and all that. This question is, did both thieves revile Jesus? Now this one is kind of silly as well. In Luke 23, verse 39 to 42, it says, "And one of the malefactors which were hanged railed on him, saying, If thou be Christ, save thyself and us. But the other answering rebuked him, saying, Dost thou not fear God, seeing thou art in the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward for our deeds. But this man hath done nothing amiss. And he said unto Jesus, Lord, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom." In Mark 15:32, it says, "Let Christ, the King of Israel, descend now from the cross, that we may see and believe. And they that were crucified with him reviled him." Matthew 27, verse 44 says, "The thieves also, which were crucified with him, cast the same in his teeth." Now the answer is, yes, both thieves reviled Jesus. Apparently, skeptics don't know what time is. The crucifixion of Jesus Christ took place over several hours. In both Matthew 27 and Mark 15, the reviling of Jesus took place near the beginning of his crucifixion, which was at the third hour, according to Mark 15:25. However, according to Luke 23, verse 44, right after Jesus speaks to this man, it says it was about the sixth hour. So yes, both thieves did revile him at first, but one of them repented and believed on Christ. So the answer to the question is yes, just one of them believed on him later, a few hours later into the crucifixion. The next question is, how many blind people did Jesus heal near Jericho? In Mark 10:46, it says, "And they came to Jericho, and as he went out of Jericho with his disciples and a great number of people, blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging." Matthew 20, verse 30, "And behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside, when they heard that Jesus passed by, cried out, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou son of David." And Luke 18:35 says, "And it came to pass that as he was come nigh unto Jericho, a certain blind man sat by the wayside begging." Now, first of all, it should be noted that Mark and Matthew are telling an entirely different story than that which is recorded in the book of Luke. Notice that in Mark it says, "as he went out of Jericho." And in Matthew 20, verse 29, it says, "they departed Jericho." And then the verse we read is right after that. So this is when they leave Jericho, not when they're coming to it. But the book of Luke says that he was come nigh to Jericho. So this certain blind man mentioned in the book of Luke, when it says certain blind man, that means exclusively one person. He was healed when Jesus first entered into Jericho, not as he was departing. This is an entirely different story. So Matthew 20 and Mark chapter 10 are telling the same story, but Mark puts emphasis on one person, which is Bartimaeus. Now, just because it only mentions one person does not mean it is saying that there was only one person there. It's just putting emphasis on Bartimaeus because he was the one who specifically called out the words, "Thou son of David, have mercy on me." But it never says that there was not a second person who Jesus healed. The statement, "blind Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, sat by the highway side begging," is still true when compared with Matthew 20:30. Yes, he was there. Just because it doesn't mention the other one doesn't mean that the story is false. So the answer to the question, how many people did Jesus heal near Jericho of blindness, is three. He healed one as he was going in and two as he was going out. And the next question is, how many angels were at the tomb? The atheists believe that this is a contradiction as well. Matthew 28, verse 2, it says, "And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it." And then Mark chapter 16, verse 5 says, "And entering into the sepulcher, they saw a young man sitting on the right side, clothed in a long white garment, and they were affrighted." And then Luke 24, verse 4 says, "And it came to pass, as they were much perplexed thereabout, behold, two men stood by them in shining garments." In John 20, verse 12, it says, "And seeth two angels in white sitting, the one at the head and the other at the feet where the body of Jesus had lain." Now, the simple answer to the question is that there are two, but we need to pay attention to the details of the whole text. Now, first, I want to point out that the source of this supposed contradiction, the quiz show video made by Non-Stamp Collector, seems to be confused by the fact that in John 20 it says two angels, while in Luke 24 it says two men, and Mark 16 it says a young man. So the other question with this is, were they angels or were they men? The answer is they were angels. Anybody who's read the Bible knows that angels are often referred to as men because they appear as men. For example, in Genesis 18 and 19, it says that three men appeared to Abraham. One of them was the Lord as the Son of God, and two were the angels that went down to Sodom to rescue Lot. Throughout both chapters, they're called both men and angels because angels appear as men. It's very simple. Now the question becomes, was there one angel or two angels? Well, firstly, the verse given in Matthew 28:2 has nothing to do with how many angels were in the tomb. This is a different event before the tomb was opened. The angel of the Lord came back and opened the stone before the women ever came to the tomb. And then he sat upon it. Then as the Marys went into the tomb, the angel went inside of the tomb of Christ with one already being inside. Now it records in Luke 24, verse 4, that there were two men who stood by them in shining garments. Well, I don't know if atheists realize this, because this is another thing that he brings up as a supposed contradiction, but there's something called standing up. If I'm sitting, which I am right now, I can do this. I can stand up, right? It's very easy to do that. But even then, if you compare this with the book of John, where it says that there were two sitting inside the tomb, that's also talking about an entirely different event. If you read the whole passage of John, you'll see that in the beginning of the chapter, Mary Magdalene departs and goes to Peter and John to tell them that the body of Christ is missing from the tomb. And then they go back to the tomb, and Mary independently sees the angel sitting. This is not when the other women came to the tomb and saw only one inside, and then the one who was sitting on top of the stone came down. So when the other women come, they first see one man sitting, as recorded in the book of Mark. The other angel comes off the stone, and the one sitting stands up, so that there are now two standing by the women, as it records in the book of Luke. The fact that it says that they stood is not a contradiction, and that's just stupid to say so. But in Mark, it only mentions a young man. Well, as pointed out before, with the story of Jericho and the blind man near Jericho, only mentioning one does not exclude the possibility of there being another. When they first entered the tomb, there was only one sitting there, and then the angel who was atop the stone came down. It's putting emphasis on this first angel, on the single angel, because he's the one who spake with the woman, told them what happened, according to Mark 16, verse 6. So if we're going to construct a chronology of these angels, first an angel rolls away the stone before the women even come to the tomb, and then he sits upon it. Then the Marys come to the tomb, and inside they see one angel sitting in the sepulcher. He stands up, and the angel atop the stone comes down and speak to the Marys. Then later, after they had left and told Peter and John about what the angels had said, they, with Mary Magdalene, came to the tomb. Mary Magdalene independently saw the two angels sitting inside. So there's no contradiction if you just understand that there's a passage of time going on here. Next question is, how many women went to the empty tomb? That's another supposed numerical contradiction concerning the accounts of Jesus' resurrection. The skeptics will say that each account says that there were different women. In John 20, verse 1, it says, "The first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene early, when it was yet dark, unto the sepulchre, and seeth the stone taken away from the sepulchre." Matthew 28:1 says, "In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulchre." Mark 16, verse 1, "And when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome had bought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him." Luke 24, verse 10, "It was Mary Magdalene and Joanna and Mary the mother of James and other women that were with them, which told these things unto the apostles." Now the claim is that John says that there is only one person, Matthew says that there is two, Mark says there are three, and Luke says that there were five or more. First of all, in the book of John, the verse next to the verse, in verse 1, so verse 2, indicates that John was simply focusing on Mary Magdalene, but not saying that there is only one at the tomb. Pay attention to what John 20, verse 2 says. "Then she runneth and cometh to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, and saith unto them, They have taken away the Lord out of the sepulchre, and we know not where they have laid him. She says, we know not where they have laid him, which indicates that she and John knew full well that there was more than one person at the tomb. It's putting emphasis on Mary Magdalene because she left the tomb immediately to return back to Peter and John. It's telling a separate story instead of focusing on the women who remained at the tomb and spake to the angels. So John is not telling us that Mary Magdalene is the only woman at the tomb. If you compare verse 1 with the first verse of Matthew and Mark, you'll notice they mention entirely different times as well. We shouldn't think of the event of the women coming to the tomb as something that just happened in a period of 5 minutes. The Bible teaches us that before the women actually entered the tomb, some time had already passed. Look at verse 1 of the book of John. It says that Mary Magdalene came to the tomb when it was yet dark. In Matthew 21 verse or 28 verse 1, it says that Mary Magdalene and the other Mary came as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week. In Mark, if you read verse 2, it says they came unto the sepulchre at the rising of the sun. In case you don't know what that means, Mary Magdalene was the first to get up and head towards the tomb. She did so when it was still dark outside, probably like 4 a.m. or sometime around then. So then, when it begins to dawn, meaning that the first light starts to appear, so it's not dark anymore, there's now light in the sky, it's gray outside, probably about 4:35 in the morning, the other Mary was with her, and they were soon joined by Salome, who went with them to buy spices, and then finally arrived at the tomb at the rising of the sun, according to the book of Mark. So this took place over the period of probably an hour or more. They had to get up, they had to gather together, buy spices, and then make the journey to the tomb. I believe that there were three women who came to the tomb and that none of the gospel accounts contradict Mark's record of there being Mary, Mary Magdalene, and Salome. But what about Luke 24, verse 10? The assumption by the Bible critics is that the phrase other women that were with them is referring to those with these women at the tomb, but that's simply wrong. Verse 10 is a record of the women coming to the apostles and telling them what the angels said. Again, it's like the Bible critics don't understand that there's such thing as a passage of time. The other women were with the Marys when they came unto the apostles, meaning they had joined the women after leaving the tomb, because they had probably informed these women first on the way to meet with the disciples. So the reason why Luke mentions five or more people is because the three who were at the tomb left, and as they were going, other women joined them when they went to the house of the disciples. So it's five women who told the apostles about what the angels said. It's not five women who were at the tomb. It doesn't say that. So there's no contradiction here either. There were three women, and no passage excludes that possibility. Next contradiction is not really a numerical contradiction. It kind of deviates. I think this is the end of the numerical thing, but it's kind of about God's attitude towards riches and what our attitude should be towards wealth and riches. Now, there's quite a few verses which this guy brings up about this matter, so let's read them. It says in Luke 6:24, "But woe unto you that are rich, for you've received your consolation." Psalm 112, verse 1 to 3 says, "Praise ye the Lord. Blessed is a man that feareth the Lord, that delighteth greatly in his commandments. His seed shall be mighty upon earth. The generation of the upright shall be blessed. Wealth and riches shall be in his house, and his righteousness endureth forever." Luke 12, verse 33, "Sell that ye have and give alms. Provide yourselves bags which wax not old, a treasure in the heavens that faileth not, where no thief approacheth, neither moth corrupteth." Luke 14, verse 33 says, "So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple." Luke 18, verse 22 says, "Now when Jesus heard these things, he said unto him, Yet lackest thou one thing, sell all that thou hast, and distribute unto the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." Acts 2, verse 44 to 45, "And all that believed were together, and had all things common, and sold their possessions and goods, and parted them to all men as every man had need." Acts chapter 4, verse 34 to 37, "Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of land or houses sold them, and brought the prices of the things that were sold, and laid them down at the apostles' feet, and distribution was made unto every man according as he had need. And Joseph, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, which is being interpreted the son of consolation, a Levite and of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it, and brought the money, and laid it at the apostles' feet." So the argument goes that Luke 6:24 is against riches, and so are the rest of these passages, with the exception of Psalm 112, which says that for those who fear the Lord, wealth and riches shall be in his house. Now stop and think about what these verses are talking about. Firstly, the obvious issue is the difference between the source of the riches and the status of the person we're talking about. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, in Luke chapter 6, the message which Jesus is preaching is known as the Sermon on the Plain, which basically holds the same teachings as the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. So he contrasts those which are his disciples with the people that are caught up in the things of the world. He says a few verses earlier, "Blessed be ye poor, for yours is the kingdom of heaven." And then he says, "Woe unto you that are rich, for ye have received your consolation." Well, Jesus said also in Matthew 19, verse 23 to 24, "Verily I say unto you, that a rich man shall hardly enter into the kingdom of heaven. And again I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God." This is after the rich man comes to him, asking what good thing he must do to have everlasting life. The parallel passage in Luke is given as one of these contradictory verses where Jesus says to the man to sell all that he hath if he will be perfect. Jesus is speaking here to an unsaved man who is trying to justify himself, somebody who is trusting in his own works and his own self to be justified. Now he leaves sorrowful because he had many riches, according to Luke 18:23 and Matthew 19:22. Jesus told him to do this to make the point that a man cannot get himself to heaven through his own works or even by his riches. Just as in Luke 6:24, "Woe unto them that have riches, for," which means because, "they have received their consolation." Now, what does the word consolation mean? It means comfort. The reason why he says woe unto them is because rich people, as a result of the abundance of possessions which they have and their personal pride, they already have comfort. They don't even think about eternity. Anybody who goes out soul winning knows that it's a lot harder to get a rich person saved than it is to get a poor person saved, because they think that they're already set for life. They don't even care about religion or the Bible or anything like that. Their focus is upon the earth and this earthly life, and not where they'll spend eternity. So Jesus is speaking to the unsaved. He's telling them that their riches are worthless in comparison to eternity, that no matter how many things that they build up upon this earth, if their soul goes to hell, it will all be in vain. As the Bible says in Matthew 16:26, "For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Psalm 112 is concerning not those who just have riches in general, but it says that God will bless the man that feareth the Lord with riches, that a saved person who walks the commandments of God. And there's multiple ways you can interpret that also, because it just says riches shall be in his house. Now, the word house is used sometimes in the Bible to not just refer to a physical dwelling place on earth, but as we read in, I think, 2 Corinthians 5, that our home is in heaven. Wealth and riches in our house doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have wealth and riches upon this earth, but it could also mean building up treasure in heaven, as Jesus said that we should do. Now, Jesus said in the New Testament also that somebody who is his disciple should forsake all that he has in order to follow after him. Now, that doesn't mean that all disciples of Jesus are going to own absolutely nothing, that they're just walking around naked every day. The issue is forsaking all that they have for Jesus' sake, to be his disciple. For example, in Matthew 10, he says, "He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me." He said, "He that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." Now, it's obviously not saying that we should just immediately die or kill ourselves, but we should be willing to lay down our lives for Christ's sake. We should be willing to give up anything that would get in the way of serving Christ and being his disciple. That's what he's saying. That doesn't mean that God will never bless a disciple of Jesus Christ, nor does it mean that God will not bless an ordinary Christian. Not every Christian is a disciple of Jesus. Discipleship means following and learning from him on a daily basis. Somebody can be an obedient Christian without being a disciple, and they can be blessed with wealth and riches. Now, concerning the last two passages which this guy gives, I don't even understand how they're claimed to be contradictory, because it's not a statement or a command of something that we should do. It's just a story of what the apostles did. They gave offerings to the church so that the church would be provided for. I mean, I don't know what that has to do with riches or anything like that, but it's not a command or a statement at all. It's just a story about what happened. It's not a contradiction at all. So, moving on, the next question is, did the temple curtain rip before or after Jesus died? Matthew 27, verse 50 to 51, it says, "Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake, and the rocks rent. Mark 15, verse 37 to 38 says, And Jesus cried with a loud voice and gave up the ghost. And the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top of the bottom, or top to the bottom. Luke 23, verse 45 to 46 says, And the sun was darkened, and the veil of the temple was rent in the midst. And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said thus, he gave up the ghost. Now the answer to this question is neither. The curtain ripped at the moment that Jesus died. And when somebody writes about an event and two things take place simultaneously, you're going to have to place the description of the event in a certain order. But that does not necessarily mean that they took place in that order. And let me give an example of what I mean. So I'll do something. I'll pick up this water bottle and I'll slap myself. I did them at the exact same time, right? And describing what I just did, I picked up a water bottle and I slapped myself. Saying that does not mean that I did that in that order. I didn't pick up the water bottle and then slap myself. I did both at the same time. I could have said I slapped myself and I picked up a water bottle, and it could have the same meaning. The point I'm trying to make is that just because Matthew and Mark write about the veil being torn after recording his final breath and Luke records it before does not mean that they're saying it happened in a different order. When Jesus took his final breath and cried out, that is when the veil of the temple is torn. And that fits with all three of the passages. Now, the next supposed contradiction is the question, did Herod or Pilate put the robe on Jesus? Matthew 27, verse 27 to 28 says, Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the common hall and gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers, and they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. Luke 23, verse 11, And Herod with his men of war set him at naught and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him again to Pilate. John 19, verse 1 to 2 says, Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers plaited a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. Now the answer is both Herod and Pilate put the robe on Jesus, because they record two entirely separate events. In the book of Luke, it's written that Pilate sent Jesus to Herod soon after meeting with him at the first. It's recorded in Luke 23, verse 7. This was before Pilate had inquired the Jews about whether or not Barabbas or Jesus should be released, which is recorded in Luke 23, verse 18 to verse 21. The other passages are after the questioning of Barabbas. In John, it records that the people said, not this man, but Barabbas, at the end of chapter 18. Now we're in chapter 19, and it begins by saying that Pilate scourged Jesus, meaning he whipped him. Now, just think about this for a second. If they whipped Jesus, they would have to take the robe off first. Matthew 27 is the same. It's after the people chose Barabbas that Pilate's soldiers put the robe on Jesus. So what happened here is that the soldiers of Herod mocked Jesus at the first with only the robe. And without taking the robe off, they sent him to Pilate. Pilate then takes the robe off after Barabbas is called out by the Jews to be the one who's going to be released. He takes the robe off when he is scourged, and his soldiers put it back on him, this time also plaiting a crown of thorns and putting a reed in his hand. It records two different events. Now, the next supposed contradiction is concerning the question, did Jesus curse the fig tree before or after driving the money changers out? In Matthew 21, verse 12, it says, And Jesus went into the temple of God and cast out all them that sold and bought in the temple and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves. Matthew 21, verse 17 to 19 says, And he left them and went out of the city into Bethany, and he lodged there. Now in the morning, as he returned to the city, he hungered. And when he saw a fig tree in the way, he came to it and found nothing thereon, but leaves only, and said unto it, Let no fruit grow on thee henceforward forever. And presently the fig tree withered away. Mark chapter 11, verse 12 to 17, And on the morrow, when they were come from Bethany, he was hungry, and seeing a fig tree afar off having leaves, he came, if haply he might find anything thereon. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for the time of figs was not yet. And Jesus answered and said unto it, No man eat fruit of thee hereafter forever. And his disciples heard it. And they come to Jerusalem, and Jesus went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold and bought in the temple and overthrew the tables of the money changers and the seats of them that sold doves, and would not suffer that any man should carry any vessel through the temple. And he taught, saying unto them, Is it not written, My house shall be called of all nations a house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves? Now, the answer to the question is simply that he did so before driving the money changers out of the temple, as recorded in the book of Mark. If you look at Mark's account, it gives the exact chronology of what takes place. It says, on the morrow when they were come from Bethany. So as Jesus was coming from Bethany unto Jerusalem, he cursed the fig tree. Then on that same day when he was come to Jerusalem, he drove out the money changers and the merchants. In Matthew's account, it's not presenting a chronology, but hearkening back to the previous morning when he cursed the fig tree. As we see immediately afterwards in Mark, after he drove the money changers out, they went out of the city again, and is written in verse 20 to verse 21, and in the morning as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots. And Peter, calling to remembrance, saith unto him, Master, behold, the fig tree which thou cursest is withered away. Notice how it says that Peter called it to remembrance. So they passed by the fig tree again. After the cleansing of the temple, they saw the fig tree. They beheld that it was withered away. Matthew mentions the entirety of the fig tree story at once. Instead of separating the different events of that story, it explains the story of the fig tree as separate to the story of the cleansing of the temple all at once. So in Matthew 21, verse 20 to 22, it records the same story as in Mark 11, 20, that the disciples saw the fig tree and noticed that it had already been withered away, which is followed immediately by Jesus' explanation of what they can do with faith in God. So again, it's not a contradiction. The book of Matthew simply refers back to the fig tree story as a separate story instead of listing every event in chronological order as in the book of Mark. The next supposed contradiction is an answer to the question, should homosexuals be killed or exiled? In Leviticus chapter 20, verse 13, it says, if a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination, they shall surely be put to death, their blood shall be upon them. 1 Kings 15, verse 11 to 12 says, and Asa did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, as did David his father. And he took away the Sodomites out of the land and removed all the idols that his fathers had made. Now the answer is they should be put to death. 1 Kings chapter 15 does not contradict Leviticus 20:13, firstly because it's not a commandment, it's a story. There have been several examples already in this video and in the previous video of skeptards failing to understand that just because the Bible records somebody as doing or saying something, that doesn't mean it's commanded or done by God. Secondly, removing the Sodomites out of the land does not necessarily mean exile. If he killed them, it would still be removing them out of the land. The Bible uses euphemisms like that to refer to putting one to death. Another one commonly used in the scriptures is cut off from the congregation, as we see multiple times in the first five books of Moses. And in many cases, it refers to being killed so that they're no longer a part of the congregation of Israel. It doesn't mean kicking them out. It means killing them so that they're no longer part of the congregation. So the verse where it says that Asa took them out of the land, that's itself, you can interpret that multiple ways. But even then, it's just a story. It doesn't say that that's a command of God or that's what a government should do. The next question is, when was Jesus born? Now, this one is based on a supposed historical argument. In Matthew chapter 2, verse 1, it says, now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem. And Luke chapter 2, verse 1 to 2 says, and it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Quirinius was governor of Syria. So the claim is that these two verses contradict because Matthew says that Jesus was born in the days of Herod the king, while Luke records that he was born when Quirinius was the governor of Syria and that a census or a taxing took place at this time. Now, the only outside source for the dating of the census of Quirinius is in 6 AD. And of course, the Bible denier does this thing where they assume that all the ancient sources except the Bible are right. And that's pretty common when it comes to interpreting the Bible and biblical history. So if there's two sources, one is the Bible and another is something that's outside of the Bible, if two of them contradict for some reason, and I know exactly what the reason is, every time without fail, the skeptard goes with the source that isn't the Bible because they just immediately assume that the Bible is the one that must be wrong while the other one is absolutely correct. So there's no reason to do so. The only source for dating the census of Quirinius in 6 AD is Josephus in the Antiquities of the Jews. Now, there's a possibility that Josephus was entirely wrong, first of all. But even saying that he was accurate with his dates, it doesn't rule out the possibility of another census. Because if you look closely at Luke chapter 2, verse 2, it says, "And this taxing was first made when Quirinius was governor of Syria," which implies that there was more than one taxing, that there could have been a second one at a later time when Quirinius was governor. And it turns out, actually, that Quirinius was a governor of Syria two different times. The word governor in the Bible simply means leader. It does not necessarily refer to a specific position. For example, Pontius Pilate is also called a governor in the Bible, but he was a provincial governor over Judea. He had the title of prefect. Quirinius, who was also appointed governor of Syria, according to the Bible, he was the legate. There are different positions in the Roman Empire, but from the perspective of God and the perspective of the Bible, they were both governors, because that word simply just means leader. So before being appointed as the legate of Syria in 6 AD, Quirinius had previously been a general from 12 BC to 1 AD against a tribe in eastern Anatolia. And this may have been a time when he was first the governor of Syria, and he took the position again a few years later. So either way, whether he ruled twice or whether Josephus was simply wrong, there's not enough adequate outside historical data to prove that Quirinius ruled exclusively from 6 AD onwards. So I believe that he was the governor around the time of Herod, and that Luke's account is not contradictory to Matthew's. Now the next question, this is the second to last actually, is was the tomb opened or closed when the women came to the tomb? In Matthew 28, verse 2, it says, "And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it." Luke 24, verse 2 says, "And they found the stone rolled away from the sepulcher." Now, I don't know why they say that this is a contradiction, because it never says in Matthew 28, verse 2, that this event took place when the women arrived at the tomb. Verse 1 never says that the women had yet arrived at the tomb. In fact, it's written, "As it began to dawn toward the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to see the sepulcher." Now it has the detail, "as it began to dawn," that is, just as the light began to shine in the sky. But as recorded in the book of Mark, chapter 16, verse 2, they did not actually arrive at the tomb until the rising of the sun. The angel rolled back the stone during the early parts of the morning before the women had arrived. And when they did arrive, they found the stone rolled away. So again, it's not a contradiction. And the last and final one is also kind of silly as well, just like all of them. Matthew 27, verse 5, "And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself." Acts chapter 1, verse 18, "Now this man purchased a field with the reward of iniquity, and falling headlong, he burst asunder in the midst, and all his bowels gushed out." So the question, how did Judas die? Well, he died by hanging himself. That's what Matthew 27, verse 5 says. Acts 1:18 never claims to be the record of his death, but simply what happened to his body. If he fell headlong, that means he was hanging from a tree. The rope broke and he fell into the field and burst asunder in the midst. That only happened because he was already dead. Okay, if you fall, you're not going to just explode open, right? If you're alive, okay? When it says that he fell, it means that after a period of time of hanging on the tree, the rope broke for whatever reason. Maybe the branch fell off or whatever. And he fell into that field and his torso split open and his bowels gushed out. Now, the reason for that is because his body had begun to decay because he was already dead. So the bacteria within him had already broken down the tissue on his torso so that when he eventually fell, the impact caused his torso to split open because the skin was weaker. It's not recording his death in Acts 1. It doesn't say anything about his death. It just simply says what eventually happened to his body. So that's the last contradiction given in that video by Non-Stamp Collector. And honestly, if somebody was an unbeliever, these would probably be the best supposed contradictions one could come up with. I've heard a lot of supposed contradictions. Some of them aren't even close to contradictions. Some of them are based on which Bible translation you use. Sometimes they purposely use some obscure like paraphrase instead of the King James Bible, and they say the Bible contradicts itself. Well, no, those are just false Bible versions. The King James Bible doesn't contradict itself. And all the contradictions which are given by skeptics are all silly. The Bible does not have contradictions. And I stand by that claim, and I will continue to stand by that claim, because every time somebody brings one up, if you actually study the verse, study the context, and compare spiritual with spiritual, it's easy to understand what it's saying. So as pointed out at the beginning of the video, if you take easy biblical principles to study, it helps you understand what it's actually saying. You compare scripture with scripture, you look at the context, consider the actual meaning of the words, and it's not difficult for the believer to understand. But of course, the skeptards will always bring out junk like this because the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God. They do not have the Spirit of God within them. They cannot understand the Bible. Most of these were not even difficult at all to answer. It didn't require much study at all. Just a simple look at the verses and like, huh? How are these contradictory? But yet you see on the comments and on the like-dislike ratio on that video by Non-Stamp Collector, and there's a lot of people who are gullible enough to believe what this guy says. A large number of these aren't even apparent contradictions. It's just the unbeliever is spiritually blind. They cannot understand the simple truth of God's word, so they start grasping at straws in a vain attempt to disprove the Bible because they don't want to admit that there is a God and that they are accountable unto him. Every time they bring up a supposed contradiction, none of them actually are. The Bible is inerrant and the Bible is perfect. So that's it for this video. This old helmet. Hello, which God are you talking about today? I'm talking about the Lord, Jehovah, Jesus Christ, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I don't know if you're a subscriber, but the same God which I talk about in every video. Thank you, everybody, for watching, and goodbye. God bless you.